we give them another couple of minutes and then. Yeah, I'm just giving them a couple. Don't want to ruin your setup. I'll do it right now. Yeah, that's better. Brilliant.
Try that and see what happens.
So welcome to University of Salford. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Lindsay Taylor, I'm the art curator here, and I'm delighted to welcome you. This project has been a collaboration with Keys Culture, and I'd like to thank Lucy, Fran, Laura and Ella for being fabulous to work with. And I'd also like to thank Anthony for being fabulous to work with. The partnership is, we've been working on a number of different things, and this is the first thing that we've really commissioned together. And I hope you've had a chance to see the work already, and if you haven't, you'll be staying around and seeing it later tonight. It is beautiful. I'm really delighted to have it here, and hopefully it could be staying around in Salford for a bit longer, so watch this space. Squid Soup, an artist collective, consists of a number of international artists, designers and researchers working collectively with digital and interactive media. And Anthony is the artist that we've worked with very closely over the last 6 months or so to develop this project. We did warn him about the weather in December. I don't know whether he actually believed how bad it could be.
We were talking in June, and it was like, yeah, that'd be fine.
But anyway, I'd like to thank everyone who has been involved, and of course the staff here at the university as well, who've been brilliant to work with, and also particularly the volunteer stewards who will be out in this weather at all times. And also the performers. We had some dancers from the university last night, and Company Chameleon are dancing tonight. So I'll hand over to Anthony in a second. I think because it's a fairly sort of small group, you're happy for people to just ask questions
sure.
as we go along,
yeah, yeah.
Is that all right? Or there will be a chance for questions at the end as well. I'd invite you to stay for a drink afterwards. There'll be some drinks served in the main foyer area. And then at 6 o'clock, if you want to go over to the plaza, at 6:15, Company Chameleon will be doing their dance performance. And then everybody is welcome to go and we'll walk through and experience Aeolian Light. So no further ado, Anthony.
Good evening on this deep, dark, terrible afternoon. Anyway, it's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to be inside. To talk to you. I'm going to talk about Squid Soup, which is the small media arts collective that I founded in about 1997, which has been through various incarnations over the years and is currently comprised of mainly four of us, myself, Gaz Bushell, Chris Benowith and Liam Birtles. We've all four been up here for the last week or so putting up the piece Aeolian Light. And Liam's gone, had to go home this morning, but the rest of us are around, so if you want to come and talk to us later, that'd be great. A bit about Squid Soup. We work with mixed reality experiences, which are a hybrid combination of the real and the virtual. And we try to combine them in interesting ways to create immersive experiences that sort of are a combination, an easy combination of the virtual and the real. We've worked with museums, art galleries, events, and we operate at the intersections of art and design, and the four of us are artists, designers, and programmers. So by mixed reality experiences, what I mean, the kind of stuff that we do are this sort of stuff here. So the left two projects use a technique called projection mapping to create the illusion that these creatures that are wandering around are actually in the physical world. What we try and do is take virtual and digital information and place it in the physical. And so using a projector, you can project onto objects. And then also using a camera, you can make these things interactive and responsive, so the creatures can run away from you or crawl up your arm or whatever. And the project on the right which is what I'm going to be talking about tonight, is part of a sort of long series of projects that use three-dimensional arrays of lights to create the illusion of space and movement in physical space. Yeah, so that's the aim of Ocean of Light, is to try and create sort of stuff that's got volume and a presence in the physical world rather than just being a flat projection or an image. We've tried to do this stuff in various ways over the years. In addition to the projection mapping, we've played around with 3D projections like this, where you're using this sort of red-green stuff. I mean, that's obviously come on a long way since 2004 when we did this with 3D cinema and so on. But it still feels it's a gimmick, really. And so we looked for different ways to create volume and presence with the work. And I was inspired by the work of this guy. This is Jim Campbell, and he's specialised in very, very low resolution work. He sort of boils it down to an absolute minimum, and the human brain is very good at filling in the gaps, and so you fill in, you sort of make up what the missing information, and it actually becomes a more creative experience as a result of that. I mean, he says that. And I'm quoting, "There's something about the existence of these works right at the level of abstraction that keeps pulling you in, almost on a subliminal or subconscious level, to try to get more from them, even though you're not." So your brain is just making stuff up, basically. But what it means is you can watch the same video many times and find it interesting. So I was inspired by that, and also intrigued by these things, which again were coming around about sort of 5-10 years ago, people playing around with just little LEDs and trying to create very, very simple animations, but in 3D. And that combined with the work of an op artist called Jesus Rafael Soto, who's done a lot of works like this. Sometimes that's just a straight cube, but he also does stuff that's got like spheres within them, so it's sort of shapes within shapes. And they're very physical, tactile experiences as well. Those are the three sources of inspiration for this whole project. In 2007, I started exploring the technical possibilities and how we could actually make this stuff, and came across this piece, which is in Zurich Central Station, and at the time was the biggest LED cube in the world. I think it's come down now, but that had 25,000 points of light in it, and it was 5 meters by 5 meters and 1 meter high. So a lot of lights, very closely packed, and also strangely suspended very high up in the ceiling at Zurich Central Station, sort of seven meters up. So it kind of looked like this sort of sandwich floating in space. And they used it, the idea was to use it to present scientific information in a volumetric, in a 3D way, but they generally used it for tic-tac-toe and 2D stuff, and so it kind of lost its point. But it was beautifully made, And they very kindly lent us one unit, which is a cubic meter, to play around with and experiment with. And so this was our sort of founding experience. It was just playing around with it, seeing what works and what doesn't. And it's very different to a pixel because there are big gaps between each point of light. And so getting that balance right, getting the blur right, because if you do it very hard edges, if you're trying to present an object that's between two of these lights, you have to blur it. Otherwise, it just becomes a very hard pixelated blob. So you can see that sort of playing with simple things like drops, raindrops, which we're seeing more of tonight. If you sort of let them fade out, you get a much smoother transition. So having played around with that, we made a couple of projects using this Nova grid. This is an image of one of the projects we did. It's called the Stealth Project, and it was built for the V&A. They had an exhibition called Cold War Modern, and this was a side event as part of that. And we were commissioned to build a game inspired by the Cold War. And so it's a game of tic-tac-toe, and you have two people that sit opposite each other and you fire through this void. But the thing about it is, I mean, it was an object, you know, that is an object, not an environment. And I was really keen to create stuff that you could be inside, be within, and immerse yourself in, rather than an object that you look at from outside. And it's also a very sort of hard, geometric, Swiss technology, very beautiful, perfectly calibrated and so on, weighs a ton. And so we thought, well, okay, let's move on and build another one. So we looked into various possibilities, and another problem with these sort of large three-dimensional structures is there's actually just a hell of a lot of repetitive work. So this one was a 2.5 meter cube, but it has 24 by 12 by 12, which is about 4,000 points of light. So we thought, you know, we could actually hand solder all this, but it would just take forever. So we got it prototyped in China. And it was an interesting experience. It was very, very different aesthetically to the first grid we played with. It had a very organic sense because they were sort of loosely suspended. They hung down. They were quite wiggly when they hung down. The very geometric form of the Nova thing, which creates these moiré effects, was much less with this piece. And also the lights themselves were very, very small. They were points of light. And one of the things you get with your impression of 3D-ness is... But there are various things. One, you know, you've got parallax as you move, things move in different ways in front of you. And another one is that things further away appear smaller. But if you've got a tiny point of light, you can't actually tell the difference. And so it had a really quite interesting quality in that it was 3D, but you couldn't quite tell. And sometimes it was, you know, you look at it and you weren't quite sure which was front and which was the back. However, the plan to be able to let people walk within it was scuppered because of two reasons. One is, as you can see, the edges are quite sharp on that, and they caught on your clothing. And so so I went in it, and that's fine, but you couldn't let the public in because they'd just like get it all caught up in their clothes and not be able to move. And additionally, all the circuits were open. And so when two strings touched each other, they'd get short circuits, and so the colours would go a bit crazy. But it was an interesting experience, and we made a couple of projects with that. And then we started to find out some of the more interesting mixed reality bits about these things at that point. So sometimes the same piece would look visceral and intense, and then in another space it would have a quite sort of tranquil and calm appearance and be a completely different experience. So it really does become a playoff between the space it's in and the piece itself. So this picture is from Connecticut Art Fair, which was in London in 2010. And we had a small space there, which was almost completely filled with this thing. We had a sort of 1 meter space corridor down two sides of this cube of lights. And there were a lot of people there, so people were right up in it. And it was all black, so the outside was black. And it was very intense. Whereas we showed the same piece in Oslo about 6 months later, in a much larger and quite empty gallery space with white walls and marble floors, and the piece felt completely different. We also showed it in Ars Electronica, which is in Austria, and the piece there seemed to have it was in a basement in a disused tobacco factory, and the piece had a sort of calm but foreboding to it. There's a sort of tension there, which was quite odd. I'll just show you a very short clip of the piece that these pictures were taken of, which was called Surface, which actually responded to sound in real time. And so because we couldn't let people get in there, we used sound instead. And it the piece is essentially a flat surface that's represented by a light, by a layer of lights, and then these sort of objects that move around within it, navigating and negotiating the space, and they respond to sound. So they make sound and they respond to it. So you get these feedback loops going on as these things would sort of swim around, make sounds, and then the whole thing would respond to that. And then you could also go in there and make sounds as well. See the blobs moving around. One of the things is it's very odd to film these things, because the whole point of them is that they're three-dimensional, they're in physical space, and yet here I am putting them on a screen. And in fact, the fact that the whole idea of a screen is one of the key reasons for doing all of these 3D projects is that, you know, that screens are so prevalent in society. And we think of cinema as an immersive medium and so on, but actually a screen is a surface, and it's an impenetrable surface, and what you're looking at is actually going on, or appears to be going on the other side of that surface in a parallel universe. Is that it's not physically located here, it's behind this window in this screen, and so we're trying to get away from that and from an interactive perspective, because all of these pieces are responsive or interactive in some way. If you're doing stuff with a screen, you're always having to deal with that sort of unnatural transition. You know, you can't, in the real world, you can't interact with something on the other side of a door or window. It needs to sort of share space with you. Okay, so Submergence was a project that we did. Was first shown at the beginning of last year, so I'm getting on for 2 years ago now, and that uses that's this is a the direct antecedent of the piece that's outside. It's called Submergence. It was first shown and sponsored by the Arts Council in Norway, and shown in a gallery there called ROM, which is an architecture and art gallery. The piece, and this finally we managed to get people to walk inside it. The piece was shown in Oslo and has also been shown in Geneva, Bristol, Holland, and in Germany a couple of times. So movement within physical space was finally possible, and we could create these abstract and evocative experiences. So you may have, just as I was coming in here, I noticed that the video is actually playing on all the screens out here. But I'm going to show you part of this video, but I'll play it at low volume and actually talk you through what's going on with this piece. So Submergence occupies a space that's 8 meters by 4.5. And has about 8,000 points of light to it. The piece really was a series of sketches in some ways. It was divided into four sections. Each one lasted about 5 minutes. And then there was a transition and it would move into the next one. The first piece here, called Lanterns, is responsive in that as you move through this space, that the idea is there are these sort of balls of light that are slowly moving through the space as though they're suspended. But as you come up to them, they either move away from you or they pop. Initially, in this piece, they move away from you, but in later incarnations, they pop. The second part is called divided space, and when if there's nobody within the space, it is like this. And I don't know if you can see it on this, but this is like a hollow cube. Within which there is a single line, a surface that's moving round and dividing the space in two. So it's become like a sort of liquid architecture. And then if you walk into it, we simulate this idea of bioluminescence, as though you were sort of floating through, or moving through an ocean full of plankton that glow in the dark when they're disturbed. And so what happens is that you leave a trail of light behind you. The third part, called swarm, uses a swarming algorithm, in which, if there is nobody in the space, you just have these hundreds of points of light that move around and are visualized within the physical lights. And each one is aware of everybody else and aware of you if you move into it. So when you move into it, much like a swarm of bees would be attracted to a pot of honey, this swarm of light comes around and starts wandering around your head. And then you can sometimes get interesting playoffs going on if you get more than one person in there, as the swarm will then sort of wander from one to the other, and you get these sort of, it almost illustrates a link between the people within the space. And finally, the last piece is called ecstasy. It's not interactive, it's just like sticking your head in fireworks. The point of it is just to, we tried to max out the experience as much as possible. So there's just these expanding spheres all over the place that just completely take over your vision. And then right at the end of this piece, we tried to go for the most intense experience we could, which is every light flashing as fast as it will flash, and all doing the same colour, but a different colour every frame. And so you just get this very hard flash, and then that's it. And so that's in all about a 20-minute piece that is just on a loop. So, having put that piece on, we learnt. There's a lot of things that we learnt, I think, and because it's quite a different project, various things came up. A lot of which surprised me and us. The first one was that because this was the first piece that was actually penetrable, you could actually go inside. We were surprised at how much the tactility affected your experience. I mean, my background, if I go further back than Squid Suit, was in doing CD-ROMs and websites and things like that. And so I come from a screen background, and this, as I said, was sort of moving away from the screen. But I hadn't really, and none of us had really considered the physical aspects of it. And, you know, and I think if it had been possible, we'd have probably gone for just points of light, intangible points of light floating in space. But the tactility became a really important part of the piece. And these, These balls, which are the same ones as we have in Aeolian Light, are actually, they're made of silicon, and they're quite nice to touch. And they're quite substantial. And so kids are quite fond of it. And it's also, the social aspects were very interesting in two ways. Firstly, just the social media. All of these pictures that I'm showing you were actually just tweeted from requested by us, just tweeted and Facebooked as a result of people going to the show and putting their pictures online. But it was also became a social space at times, although not always. It was very interesting to watch. I spent quite a long time, particularly in Bristol, but also in other places, watching people engage with the piece and what kind of atmosphere they created, how they engaged with it. And there seemed to be two main modes: there's the social and the contemplative. So, you know, at times, usually when there's a lot of people in there, you know, people get their phones out and take selfies because the lights are going at it from crazy angles. It's a very photogenic opportunity. And parties were held in there. And yet at other times, which was probably more in keeping with my initial imaginings for the piece, is a much more sort of contemplative and calm approach, where you sort of stand in there for a while and you're just sort of soaking up the atmosphere and kind of working out what's going on, but it doesn't really matter. It's much more of an atmosphere and an ambience. And usually that's, you know, obviously if there are fewer people there, you're going to have less of a party. But on several occasions I went in, again this was in Bristol, and you'd have upwards of 30 people in this space, and they'd all be sitting on the floor, and it was a cold floor. You know, this was an unheated building in October. And there'd be people just sort of zoning out down there. But then at other times people just get up and have much more of a party. And it could quite often just suddenly switch from one to the other. You know, it would be all very calm, and then suddenly one person would get up and 10 people would get up and start talking, and the place transformed instantly. Another thing that I'd like to talk about a little bit is just this idea of augmented space. You know, the piece consists of 8,000 points of light, but it occupies a space, and every space is different. So as I was saying with the previous piece, each place you put it on is different, but it responds to that space in a different way. I mean, this place, you can see there are two beams that go across there, and sometimes when you have the contrasting light in front from behind those beams, the beams would stand out in sharp contrast against their background because they'd be reflecting the light in front of them and placed against the light behind them. And so suddenly they'd be there, and then other times, like this, they'd almost disappear. The strongest experience in terms of just sort of being disoriented and transported and I guess immersed is if you put it in a black cube. But I don't think that's really the most interesting one. I mean, it is interesting, but I think this idea of mixing the physical with the digital has got a lot more going for it. And the other issue is daylight. Obviously, when you're playing with lights, the challenge of daylight is a real, very real one, which is one of the reasons we're here in December, I think, rather than June, is you don't get so much daylight here in December. it transforms the experience, and so that this is the first one in Oslo, and during the day, the piece was completely different to in the evening when it was much darker. So, a few words about Aeolian Light. I'm afraid I don't have fantastic pictures because it was only soft launch yesterday. This was the artist's rendering that we put as part of our proposal in the first place. And the idea, that the sentence that we put together that sort of epitomised the project, it was inspired by our visit to this place between the Lowry and the Lowry Centre on a very windy day, and apparently it is windy quite a lot up here. And so that became the inspiration for the piece. And Aeolus is the Greek god of light, of wind. And so Aeolian light is an homage to him and the place, I think. And we say it's a monolithic interactive light installation in the heart of Salford Quays that visualises the wind as an illuminated chaotic force. So what we're trying to do with the piece is create this... it's making visible the imagined. So we're imagining these digital artifacts that are invisible to the naked eye and that are being carried in on the wind. And as they go through the grid of light, suddenly they become visible. And then as they disappear off the other end, they disappear again. And as with submergence, your presence within the space causes disturbance within this digital ether. And that too becomes visualized. So, but additionally, I think the idea, one of the attractions of that approach was that it becomes a multi-sensory experience, and the visual and what you sense with your skin reinforce each other. Because if you stand out there, you can feel the wind on your cheek, and you can see these things floating past in the same direction on the wind. And I hope that they will reinforce each other, but you will tell me if that works or not. Putting the piece up was a challenge, and it's the largest piece we've ever done. Submergence was 8 meters by 4, and this one is a 12-meter square. So that they put the rig up. We then placed 12,000 individually addressable points of light onto it, with an awful lot of connections, and then the whole thing was lifted up into a height of 5 meters, and so it's like this floating cube of light within the space. I'll just talk a little bit about the technical side. We use a wind sensor, so that obviously the wind speed and wind direction are then taken into a computer and used as the basis for generating this landscape of imagined digital artifacts that are floating through the space. And to track the people within the space, we used to, with submergence, we used Kinect sensors, which are 3D cameras built for the Xbox games controller. But for Aeolian light, we've decided to use a sick scanner, partly because the Kinect doesn't work outdoors, and also it doesn't have the range that we needed. So a single scanner scans underneath the grid of lights, because if you scan within the grid of lights, you just get all this detritus, and it's impossible to work out what's going on because it would pick up all of the lights. And so, but by going underneath, you're picking up people's feet, and people's feet are generally underneath their bodies, so it's quite a good way of actually tracking people. So the scanner visualizes, this is the control interface that's on the laptop in the Lowry. As you can see, the orange dots around are actually the stairs, and then you've got the four columns around all those squares, which is where the support columns are that hold the rig up. And then the little white dots in there are people, and so that's being constantly updated. And you've got the wind sensor information in the top left, and so that's how it's controlled. That's about all I have to say, really. That's a little shorter than I thought. But I thought I'd leave you with this glorious image that captured the weather. the soft launch last night. And so, yeah, I'd just like to finish by thanking Keys Culture, Lucy, Laura, Ella, and the rest, and also Lindsay at the University of Salford for making this project possible. And if you want to follow updates of on the project or on us, there's hashtag SquidSoupKeys is the Twitter hashtag, and at SquidSoup is us. Our website, squidsoup.org. That's about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anthony.
Pleasure.
Does anyone have any questions they'd like to ask? Because, I mean, one thing I want to say is this is the first time you've worked outside, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it the last time you've worked outside?
Possibly. Yeah, I think working outside has been a massive challenge. And as we said, I mean, at the beginning, when I came up here and we were talking about it, it was actually, I mean, it was windy, but it was a balmy day. And it's very hard to imagine in the middle of summer what it's going to be like in December. And, you know, there are a lot of technical challenges, which, I've been working on, well, we've all been working on the project for several months, but a lot of that time has been spent just waterproofing, you know. So on the top of the, I don't actually have a picture of it, but you can see there, along the top of that rig, there are 36 boxes with 12-volt transformers on it. And there are also 9 boxes that hold DMX universes, and the controllers for those. So, and there's a lot of universes required to control that many points of light. And also, you know, things happen that you don't expect. So when they put the trussing structure up, the alignment wasn't right, so we couldn't. Our initial plan was to place the lights within these the sections of, it's called unistrut, these steel sections that go across, but they couldn't place them right because they crashed into the horizontal, the sort of diagonals on the trussing, and so they weren't regular enough. So we had to find another way. You know, so it all just takes. It takes time, and it also has to be robust and so on. It's certainly been through its paces in the last couple of days.
Yeah. Well, I think because we talked as well initially about putting a roof on, didn't we?
Yes.
A blackout, because we thought then it would work better during the daytime. But then I think we were warned that if it snowed and there was a certain level of snow, that would be too heavy and then it would become dangerous. So
yes, and there was also there was a health and safety meeting in about September or October. That's a couple of you may have been at it, but it was a terrifying experience for me. I was talking about 160 mile an hour winds, and I was thinking, what? So, yeah, and yes, so, you know, the original plan was to have a roof over it, which would have been a lot easier.
Yeah.
But, you know, if the thing took off, that would have been less than satisfactory, obviously.
Yeah.
And then we were talking about a sort of semi-permeable scrim that would cut out the light. And so on. But I'm really pleased with the way it works within the space. I mean, I was concerned because there is a lot of, obviously, in the day, but also at night, you've got all those spotlights. But I think the space works really well. I could do without the Christmas trees in the back, but, you know, that's part of the festive season. What can you do?
Does anyone else have any questions?
How long did it take
to put up? Well, we prepare. The preparations took a long time, but we've been on site since, was it last Thursday we came up? Last Wednesday or Thursday? I think we came up last Wednesday. Yeah, so, well, last Thursday, we came up Thursday, so it's a week, but it's been a week of 4 of us working flat out, I mean, getting up at 7 and going to bed at 2, I think if we were to do it again, we'd take a lot longer to install it, because it was just because everything, you know, as we started thinking through the ramifications of it, and you know, and also all sorts of different things happened that you don't plan for at the beginning, like where the computers are was changed for various reasons, and so it ends up being 100 metres away, which means that the channeling's got to be sorted out, and we've got to get special cable that can actually transmit the data that far, and so on. And you know, and then all these little details, like how do you attach the scanner, which I showed you, how does that get attached to the trussing? When we don't have a, you know, we have the trussing, but we don't know where they're going to put their concrete blocks, and we don't know, and they didn't know until last until a few days before they actually put it up. They didn't know whether they were going to need braces on them, because if they had braces on them, that would completely mess up our scanner, because they'd just get in the way of everything, and then we'd have to move and think again. And you know, so a lot of last minute decisions have to be taken in these projects always, unless you're better organised than me.
There's a lot of things which are very sort of responsive to actually install-wise to the site as well. And usually it takes about 1.5 times longer than it does to do something indoors if nothing goes wrong. So it's quite a sort of curve of activity, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think we were, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, you may say as locals that this is just like what it is up here, but there was a lot of rain in the last week.
Didn't your area get flooded out a couple of years ago?
Just out of curiosity, what's the current draw on that?
I'm not sure. Oh, it's running off a three-phase 32 amp single, so it's divided between the three phases. But the current draw, I mean, they're LEDs, and the maximum. Each LED is rated at 0.6 watts, and there's 12,000 of them, but that's if they're all full on. You know, so when and what we found is that the three phase, the reason we use three phases, we've always used two phases until this one, but this is 50% bigger than submergence, is that the transformers, because there's so many transformers, and the transformers are quite highly rated for, I mean, they're over spec for what they're supposed to do, but they have a spike on startup, and so you need the current at the moment of turn on, but it doesn't use anything like that normally.
Does it previously
what with the Aeolian light? We're still playing with the exact details of it. We've been choreographing it today. The final decision, as far as I know, unless it's changed since I've come in here, is that the piece has two main modes, which are if there are people in it or if there aren't. So if there are people in it, the main focus is on the sort of the plumes of disturbance that you generate by being within it, and if you're not there, there is this the digital landscapes and detritus disturbances are generative, and so but we've been looking a lot at textures for particularly if there's nobody in there, and the reason for that is that I don't think, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens, but when the weather's not great, I don't think people are going to be hanging around in it for that long. So I think people might be looking at it from a distance more than they would if it was in a gallery. Yeah. I've underestimated a lot. Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see what happens. But, it works. It works. The point is it works in either mode. But it's, you know, it responds to the wind speed as well. So when the wind speed is higher, there'll be more disturbance. It'll be more chaotic than when on a calm day. If you get such things, do you have calm days around here?
Not often.
What sort of things are you working on for the future as well? What ideas-wise?
Well, we've got the two main avenues, and they're both at fairly preliminary levels. Well, one of them is with Ocean of Light and all of these projects that I've shown you today, including Aeolian Light, they're centrally controlled from a computer. Because the idea is really, it's a bit like an exploded screen. It's like if you take a screen and blow up the pixels and suspend them in space, then you can start to use them in a 3D way. But the points of light themselves are interesting. And just a point of light in space is an interesting thing. And so we're looking at ways of maybe just using the light as a light. And so and having, again, quite a few lights, but not having them centrally controlled and having them individuals and aware of each other or aware of the environment they're in and responding to it. And so, you know, if you see a field on a windy day, you can see the waves of the wind going across the field. So we're trying and simulate that, or not simulate it, but actually recreate that, but using light. And so you'd have all these individual autonomous units that are not centrally controlled, but just responding off each other and off the environment. And we're also at very preliminary stages of exploring the possibilities of real bioluminescence as well. So using, I forget the name of the bacteria now, but there are various types of bioluminescent bacteria that you can control when they go on and go off. And there's this thing called Angel's Glow, which was first discovered, I think, in the American Civil War. Which was at times quite sort of wet and trench-like, and people would have wounds, and they'd glow in the dark. The wounds would glow in the dark, and this is apparently because of this bacteria, which also has antibacterial properties. And so your wound, if your wound was glowing, apparently it was a good sign. but we've done some experiments with a bacteria derived from squid. Nothing to do with the name squid soup, just happens to be. It was meant to be, wasn't it? and so this stuff, if you put a file of it, it'll glow, but very, very faintly. But if you shake it, it goes bright, and then it fades out again over a minute or two.
It's like soup water, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that whole stuff of those plankton and things as well. I mean, that stuff is just absolutely beautiful. And so we're looking at ways to possibly create sort of physical animations in space using that as well. This has got, I can't remember the exact number, about 12,000. It's a grid of 24 by 24 by 21. So, and the reason for having 21 is an odd number, but it just works in terms of how DMX universe is structured. And so, in fact, you get one DMX universe corresponds to 8 strings. And so we've got 72 universes. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this piece, I'm not sure if I mentioned that, but this piece, the tactility of it and the fact that it moves physically with the wind as well, I think really, really enhances it. I mean, I'm surprised, because I'm not really tactility isn't my thing. I've come, as I explained, I come from the digital side of it more. Yeah, but I think it's fantastic, and it's, how's it affected me? I think the effect that it's had has been resulted in this piece, because it's the sort of the combination of physical, tactile, and atmospheric conditions just brings it all, makes it all, it's just making it real, you know, and it's I think it's an interesting balance between the ephemerality of light, which is obviously it's there but it's not there, you can see it but you can't touch it, and the physical objects is very interesting. But but it was a surprise, but it's great.
I mean, it's a very different experience when you actually walk through it to standing back and looking at it. I mean, we went and had a little go last night in the pouring down rain. So I do hope it stopped, because it is the sort of thing that you do want to spend time walking through. But it's on till the 7th of January. So hopefully there'll be some dry days between now and then, so you can come and experience it. Has anybody else got any other questions?
One small one. The initial inspiration came from a very real reality of this thing is dangling streamers. And the grid that that sets up is imperfect.
Yeah.
There's a question here somewhere about whether the lack of perfection in that grid diminishes the potential that we originally saw in kind of exploding into three dimensions, a single two-dimensional screen.
I think the three different grids that we've used have all got very different aesthetics. To me, it was a relief to get away from that industrial rigidity. I would like to say that actually that Nova thing was not an inspiration for the piece. It was something that I discovered, having worked out that I wanted to work with these three-dimensional arrays of light, and they'd already done it, and so we partnered up for a while. So I wasn't really looking for something that rigid and also that dense, because the Nova is very, you know, they're as I recall, I think the balls are about 4 centimeters in diameter, and they're only 10 centimeters apart. So you can just about put a hand in there, but you certainly can't stick your head in it. And my inspiration, what was in my head, was to create environments rather than objects. And so I wanted to be, from the beginning, I wanted to be inside the space. One of the, also on the Nova, the first one, you get these quite strong wire effects, which are the, you know, if you look at a very regular grid, you get these crisscross patterns that change, which is, I mean, it's very nice, but it's, and we played with it originally, but the second grid, which was even more sort of organic and irregular than this one, you know, I think it was a bit of a liberation in some ways to get away from that rigidity. And having sort of engaged with the tactility and the physicality of it, I think this piece is... I mean, I really like the way it moves in the wind, and you can see the wind get moving through it. So I don't see the irregularity as a problem. But I mean, there are pros and cons to both.
If nobody else has got any further questions, Anthony, it is beautiful. I really do love it, and it's just so fabulous to actually see it here after our conversations. I think it was April when we started talking initially.
Yeah.
And despite the weather, thank you so much for, on everyone's behalf, for spending the last week in your waterproofs from 7 till 2 in Salford in the rain. And thank you for a really interesting and fascinating talk about your work too. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
There will be drinks served outside in the foyer area, so please do go and grab a drink. And I think Anthony will be hanging around if you've got any questions you want to ask him individually. And then at 6 o'clock, make your way over to the plaza for a performance by Company Chameleon. Thank you. Thank you very much for braving the weather tonight.
Fran Crumpet's up with the radio station, so she's left a message for them to ring Chris instead of you. But could you phone them
in
case they don't get it, because it's 2 minutes to five. So.
Is that right?
Sorry, there weren't more people here because we had over 70 registered. I was really excited. That's my new bad friend thing.
I'm not that surprised though, because I've seen what it's like
the
out there.
Hello, Claire. Do you know Anthony?
Yeah.
Do you?
Okay.
I came and said hello.
Oh, right,
this is the beginning, yes. So. Yeah, I haven't seen each other for a while. Feels like another life.